Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
Alden Smith is going to be a Cowboy. Now, I'm not saying that the guy who has not played in the NFL since 2015 is going to be on the CBS Sports Network and go all PBR with it. I'm not talking about dude roping calves and barrel racing. Not that kind of cowboy. I'm saying he's going to be a Dallas Cowboy, a member of the Dallas Cowboys football team. No, he has not been reinstated to the NFL yet, but apparently he has signed a deal with Dallas that'll make him a Cowboy if or when he is reinstated. So let's be really clear about this. The Cowboys still do not have an agreement to pay Dak Prescott, but they're going to sign Alden Smith. They have not agreed to deal with the face or to a deal with the face of the franchise, the guy that they're building everything around, but they did find time to make a deal with a guy who has not played a down since 2015. And yeah, I know, teams can multitask. I understand teams can walk and chew gum at the same time. Just because they're still working on a deal with Dak does not mean that they can't sign somebody else. I understand that. Except in this case, the optics are absurd. And here are the optics: that you don't want to give Dak what he has earned, but you're busting your ass to sign a guy who has not even played since 2015 and is not even eligible at the moment. Those are your optics. Do you know how long ago 2015 was? Dak Prescott was still at Mississippi State the last time Smith was playing in the NFL. And I understand, Smith has potential, or had potential. He did show a ton of it with the 49ers when he had 47.5 sacks in 59 games. I mean, nobody ever said the guy didn't have crazy talent. I know that. Here is what else I know. I also know that he has dealt with serious issues off the field. But apparently, that is not a problem for Jera. It never is. Apparently, it's totally cool with Jera. Because you know Jera and his crew will spin it like, this guy's done the hard work on himself. He's gotten healthy. Yeah, I hope so. I hope that's the case. Not from a football standpoint, but from a life standpoint. I really hope that Alden Smith has done the hard work. And if he has, great. Good for him. I'm just not sure I'd be rushing to sign him to a contract. But the Cowboys are. And it smacks of desperation, and the optics are terrible. I mean, it goes without saying that there are certain guys who cannot get gigs in the NFL, even though they have never committed a crime. And it also goes without saying that there are guys who will always get another chance, regardless of how ridiculous their track record is. I mean, do you remember some of this guy's deal? Do you remember some of the stuff this guy did? There was the time, just about 2 years ago, when he was arrested after the San Francisco Chronicle reported that he had a blood alcohol level of 0.40. That is more than five times the legal limit here in California. Or to put it another way, as Dr. Keith Humphreys, an addiction expert and professor in Stanford's Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Science, told the Chronicle, quote, "The amount of alcohol is the equivalent of the anesthesia for major surgery. A normal type person would be blacked out, unconscious, and at risk of a coma." End quote. That is an amazing quote. This dude was anesthesia drunk. Like, so blasted, you could have cracked him open and performed open heart surgery on him. That drunk. Humphreys also said that by being able to, quote, walk around at 0.40, he has to be exceptionally alcohol dependent already. Anyone at that level has a serious alcohol problem, end quote. And the worst part about that story is the authorities did not find him. He found the authorities. He was arrested, or I should say reportedly tested, when he arrived at the sheriff's department to be fitted for an alcohol ankle monitor. And that's when he blew a 0.4. Dude showed up at the sheriff's department to report for alcohol-related discipline, blasted. Think about that for a minute. And on top of that, that was his third arrest in the last month at that time. So in November 2015, Aldon Smith was suspended by the NFL for a year for violating the league's substance abuse policy. And then a few months later, in one of my favorite sports stories ever, he shows up on Periscope with a video titled Fire Up Session. Do you remember this? Now, if you don't remember the video, let's just say that the Fire Up Session was not about him giving a motivational speech. This is not what this is. This is not a guy in the gym. This is not Cam Newton with his workout vids. This is not LeBron in the gym getting work in. It was not that kind of fire up session. It was this kind of fire up session.
Ain't nobody f***ing with us. We got zero followers. Why is the ashtray up? This is what you call a fire up session.
Quote, this is the guy now. I don't give a bleep. Ain't nobody bleeping with us. We've got zero followers. Where is the ashtray at? This is what you call a fire up session. This is this guy on Periscope. So the woman he was with in the video is actually trying to protect him. She tries to stop him. She does her best to save him from himself.
You're stupid. You're tripping. They don't know it's me. It's not like I put Aldon Smith.
Quote, you're stupid, you're tripping, bleep. They don't know it's me. It's not like I put Aldon Smith. And then the video cuts out at that point.
They don't know it's me. It's not like I put Aldon Smith.
Genius. Man, you gotta love a guy saying, they don't know it's me. It's not like I put Aldon Smith.
It's not like I put Aldon Smith.
I mean, what's better than that? Nothing. This dude needs to keep his name out his mouth. Listen, that's before we get into the allegations of domestic violence, false imprisonment, assault, hit and run, DUI, and vandalism. I'm all about people getting a second chance, a third chance, hell, a fourth chance in life. But man, this is one hell of a look for the Cowboys. You would think that having multiple arrests, a 0.40 BAC when you're being fitted for an alcohol monitor, and a fire up session on camera might be enough to keep you out of the NFL for the rest of your life. You think that might make you unemployable, but apparently it makes you a Dallas Cowboy. How about them Cowboys?
How about them Cowboys?
Yeah! Not like I put Aldon Smith.
No, not like that at all. This guy has not played since 2015, and yet they're the Cowboys to bring him back and try and sign him to a deal. Mitchell Schwartz is my guest. Mitchell, it's so good to have you on. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Hey, listen, really good to have you. I want to talk to you about football and food and life in general, but bring me up to date. How are you and your family doing right now in this time of challenge and crisis?
We're doing well. Thanks for asking. Like you said, the chef part of me has just been staying at home cooking a bunch. Obviously now you can't really go out to eat too much, and something I always loved. And so we're doing our best here. We've done a lot of cleaning around the house, gotten rid of a lot of stuff we didn't have or we didn't realize we had lying around, and just taking it day by day. Obviously this whole situation is pretty crazy, and with the flattening of the curve, it's gonna kind of prolong things, but that's going to help with people getting the medical care that they need. So just doing our part, and then trying to show off some food stuff on social to keep people happy.
You're doing that too. In fact, you're doing work, especially as it relates to you being a chef, because anybody who follows you on Twitter knows that you are a chef. Yesterday, you posted a pic of a pepperoni pizza, which I thought was amazing. Can you break that down for me? What was the process on that pizza, and then how good was it?
Yeah, I think people have a misconception that pizza is difficult to make or it's this long process, and it really doesn't need to be. I make my own dough fresh, and so, it's four ingredients, and you mix it together. You let it sit on the counter for a few hours. You come back, you portion it out, you stick it in the fridge, and then, the dough is ready for you when you need it to be. It's really that simple. And then I don't really have anything, too fancy that people need to cook with. I don't have a pizza oven or a wood-fired oven. I just use my oven in my house. I do have what's called a baking steel, which is similar to a pizza stone or something that you put in the oven to get some extra heat in there. And I cook it in there for, you know, about 4 minutes. And so the steel is able to heat it from the bottom. I use the broiler to heat it from the top. 4 minutes, you know, in your house, you don't have to go outside, you don't have to be cold, be hot, any of that stuff. You can get it all done indoors. And as you said, I mean, the pizza looks great and tastes just as good.
Brother, I thought you said this was not complicated.
To me, that's not complicated.
To me, it is.
You know, I've done a lot more complicated food stuff. But to me, I mean, like I said, you don't have to, like, you know, knead the dough by hand and do all that stuff that I think people think about when they think about dough.
Now, you're much sharper than I am, because to me that's complicated, but it's an amazing-looking pizza. I could keep going, because somebody actually came at you. You'd post a pic of a recent breakfast and a 4-minute poached egg, bacon, toasted bagel, cream cheese, everything seasoning. It's an amazing-looking breakfast. And then somebody jumps in with a reply that reads, looks good, but egg and bacon are overcooked. Try a 3-minute egg next time. I actually use my toaster as the timer. Egg goes in, bread goes down, toast pops up, egg comes off. I mean, it's one thing for people to come at you from a football standpoint. When you see that response to your breakfast, what's your reaction?
You know, I really take more pride in the food part of it. You know, some people come to me for the food, I get, you know, a little more frustrated than I do when they come to me for football stuff. So, you know, the food stuff, I mean, you're pouring, you know, everything you can into that, and you're trying to share it with people. I mean, like I said, trying to brighten the mood during these times.
And, right.
Look, I like bacon the way I like it. I don't want it chewy. I don't want it fatty. You know, I don't want to chew into something and have to tear it off, especially when you're eating, you know, a bagel like that. The worst thing you can do is, you know, have a whole piece of bacon, you know, sliding off. And so I cook the way I like. I mean, I try to like to think that most people would enjoy it the same way. And so, yeah, every now and again you get a comment that, you know, kind of just needs a little bit of a response.
Mitchell Schwartz is joining us. I'm with you on that. All right, so it's hard to believe, but we're only 2 months and one day removed from you winning the Super Bowl. As you look back on that game, what's the first thing that comes to your mind?
It's weird to say at this point, but just, like, happy that we were able to get the game in. I mean, you know, my wife and I have been talking about that, you know, for the past few weeks. Is, I mean, on a selfish level, this thing, you know, was timed out well in the sense that we could, you know, finish the season off. And can imagine, you know, with the college basketball season, for instance, you know, going through all that hard work and then getting the ability to, you know, play for the championship taken away from you. And so, I mean, that's a crazy thing right now. But, you know, looking back to the game, I mean, what an experience. You know, I think it was the ultimate team win. I mean, I think when people think about, you know, the Chiefs in the postseason, especially this past year, is all the holes we dug ourselves into and dug ourselves out of. And so really just resilience from the team. I mean, being down, you know, 24 against Houston and whatever it was against Tennessee, and then, you know, clawing back in the Super Bowl. Just a resilient group, and, I mean, man, what a game.
Mitchell Schwartz joining us. That's exactly it, right? You were down 20-10 with less than 7 minutes to go. You rip off 21 straight to win that game. Like, I know you'd been there before, but not on that big of a stage and having to come back like that. So what was the mood like on the sideline and in the huddle in the fourth quarter?
Yeah, I mean, we had not been there before, that's for sure. And so, you know, I think we've seen all the videos of Pat, you know, kind of walking around just making sure people's spirits are kept up. And that's one of the big things, is we wouldn't have been in the Super Bowl if we didn't have that toughness and that resilience. I mean, like I said, we got down, you know, in the other two playoff games, and we had, you know, challenging points throughout the season. And so the team had confidence in each other, and that was probably the most well-rounded team I've ever been a part of. I mean, there's no point in the season where, you know, the offense isn't playing so well and the defense, you know, starts sniping at you and you come off the sidelines after a 3-and-out and you guys pick it up, you know, that type of stuff. That just doesn't happen with this team. So, you know, the offense, we trust the defense. I mean, that 49ers offense was a beast. And so what our front four did against that offensive line and what our skill guys did against their receivers, I mean, talking about a team that, you know, can match up with a speed to speed. And so, you know, just trusting the defense to get a critical stop, which they did after we turned the ball over. And, you know, offensively, we knew, you know, if we could get back on the field, I mean, Pat's going to make a couple incredible plays, and, you know, he sure did.
Super Bowl champion Mitchell Schwartz joins me for a few more moments. And you mentioned, Pat, you wrote a great piece for the Players Tribune where you made the point that, quote, I don't think I've ever seen a guy as young as Pat who is also the kind of leader that he is, end quote. What is he like as a leader, and how do you explain him being at that level this early in his career?
Yeah, the leadership thing, it's not, I don't think he even, like, thinks about it. It's just, like, his way of being. You know, it's kind of interesting to watch from afar, but I mean, when we traded Alex and, you know, Pat was the guy, you know, they didn't have any forced conversations or forced, you know, team speeches or you know, kind of awkward breaking down the huddle at the end of practice or any of that. I mean, it's just so natural for him. It's just, you know, something that I don't think he, you know, even has to think about or really say, hey, what do I need to do to help the guys? It's just what he does. And so I think that's, you know, a benefit. Obviously, the baseball stuff with his dad and being around athletes his whole life. I think he's just kind of used to this style of life. And, you know, he just knows as a quarterback, everyone looks up to him. I mean, whether the quarterback's, you know, the best player in the world or not, you know, guys look up to the quarterback. And so I think it's just been ingrained in him for a while. And, you know, being as young as he is, he also reaches, you know, everybody on the roster. And so I'm, I don't know, 7 or something years older than him. And, you know, he's the guy I look up to lead the way.
That's amazing praise. You know, Mitchell, I was at that AFC Championship game, and I was there. I remember we drove into the stadium, and it was the most amazing thing. As part of the crew for the NFL on CBS that day, we hit the air, I think, at 12 noon, and we were getting into the stadium, I want to say at 8 a.m. There was already a line snaking all the way down the hill into town of people lining up to get into the stadium for a game that was not going to be played for another 7 or 8 hours. Like, I had never seen anything like it. I bring it up because a few years back, when you were a free agent, you had some options in front of you. Kansas City was one of them, of course. Your brother and co-author of Eat My Schwartz, Jeff, had played in KC. What did he tell you about that city and their fans?
Yeah, he told me, you know, Coach Reed is awesome. You know, that was one of the biggest reasons I came here was knowing what Coach had done in Philly and kind of the foundation he had laid in Kansas City and, you know, the stability of the organization. And so my brother had told me about all that. And then he said on game day, kind of to your point, the coolest thing you'll ever experience is, you know, driving to the game. And from half a mile away, you'll see this kind of layer of smoke. And it's all the Arrowhead fans out there tailgating, cooking barbecue. And so you pull up into the stadium, and as a big guy who likes to cook, you know, you get to smell that wood burning. You get to smell the barbecue walking into the stadium. And there's nothing like it. I mean, the fan support is, you know, crazy. I mean, it's something that, you know, we realize when, you know, we had this run of success, you know, just how huge Chiefs Kingdom was, and some of the shots from the parade. I mean, we had over 1 million people on a day that was, I don't know, 32 or 34 degrees come out and cheer us on. So, I mean, the fans are awesome. You know, Arrowhead, it's an amazing experience. And, you know, games like that in particular, as you said, it's just something that you don't see elsewhere.
Hey, Mitchell, last thing. I wish that day was 32 or 34. It was not close to 32 or 34. I grew up not far from where you grew up. I don't know if your Cali blood is like my Cali blood. I'm literally still not right from that day. What was that like playing in that weather? I mean, you guys might have benches that are heated to go back to, but what was that like for you as a California native?
Yeah, so our equipment has done a great job with that. So I actually wear like a wetsuit top type of thing. And so it's basically like, you know, I got to jump in the Pacific Ocean and get all frozen. So I tend to wear that when the temperature gets below about 30 or so. That's the best way for me to keep the air in. You know, I wear braces on both of my elbows, so I'm able to kind of do the O-line cheat where you're able to technically not wear sleeves, but you still got a good bit of coverage there. And yeah, like you said, you got to rely on the heated benches. You know, I keep my house at a pretty brisk temperature in the winter, in part to kind of get used to being a little bit colder, because I do know that you know, I'm not used to it. My body didn't grow up around it. And so, you know, as a lineman, I also have a little bit more insulation than you would just naturally. So I got to rely on kind of all those things. And, you know, I think as an offensive lineman, it's something that I personally enjoy. I mean, you know, anything that can kind of get into a defensive lineman's head and make him, you know, think a little bit less about beating me and make him think, you know, more about something else.
And then, do you know the name Bernie Ecclestone? Why don't we talk about Bernie for a minute? Depending on your familiarity with Formula One, you may or may not know that name, Bernie Ecclestone. If you don't, you're about to. Bernie is the former chief executive of F1. He worked his way up through that company to eventually run the entire thing for 40 years before he stepped away back in 2017 for a cool $3 billion, which he put in his pocket. So he's rich as hell. He's successful as hell. He's famous as hell. And he is old as hell. 89 to be exact. Turning 90 in October. Man, good for him. And even better for him is that he is in great health. In fact, he might be in too great of health. because 89-year-old Bernie Ecclestone of F1 fame and fortune is now expecting a baby boy with his 44-year-old wife this summer. Congratulations, I guess. First off, the guy's older than Rit. The fact that this fossil is still able to roll around in the sack is amazing. And to borrow an analogy or a pun from racing, the fact that this guy has any gas left in his tank is unbelievable. But that's about as much 89-year-old reproductive sex as I ever want to talk about on this program ever again. So why don't we get down to the brass tacks and the truly wild math surrounding this birth announcement. These stats are incredible. So Bernie is 89 and he's about to have a baby. The same guy expecting a child this summer had his first kid back in 1955. This dude had his first kid nearly 10 years before I was born. So this dude's soon-to-be oldest sister is in her mid-60s. Can I stress that one more time? This little dude's soon-to-be oldest sister is in her mid-60s. You know, like some of you probably think, yeah, man, it's wild. Like, obviously, I was a mistake. My next oldest sibling is 9 years older than me. Yeah, well, this kid's next oldest sibling is 65 years older than him. All right, so his soon-to-be oldest sister is in her mid-60s. His soon-to-be dad is nearly 90. And his soon-to-be mom is only 44. Now, the good news is the 89-year-old dad, the 65-year-old sis, and the 0-year-old son can all gum the same mashed up food. As crazy as those numbers are, they can all have the same dinner the second that kid hits the earth. So going to the grocery store is not going to be that big of a headache. Grab some diapers for all three of them, some liquid oatmeal, and call it good. That is some same single aisle shopping right there if I have ever seen it. That's the good news. The disturbing news is that a baby boy is about to have a 90-year-old bag of bones for a dad. I mean, the average life expectancy of a man in this world is 78. So a tip of the hat to Bernie for dunking on that by 12 years and counting. But let's not sit here and pretend like it's a lock that he's going to be around to teach that kid things. Things like how to drive. And if right now you're getting upset with me for saying that, take it up with the Census Bureau and science and widely printed stats available to anybody with an internet connection or a library card. If you got these two behind the wheel together, then you've got Bernie living to be 105, which would be awesome. Just don't come at me for saying it's unlikely. Look, I'm not trying to kill a guy on the radio, but there's a massive degree of selfishness, if not recklessness, in bringing a kid into the world when Pop is on the 18th hole of life. Bernie was born in 1931. People born in 31 are not supposed to be bringing kids into the world in 20. Why don't we take a little trip back to 31? You were there, Rit. Let's talk about it. Lefty Grove beat out Lou Gehrig and Babe Ruth for the MVP. The Great Depression and Prohibition were happening. Herbert Hoover was in office. Gas was 10 cents. Rent was 18 bucks a month. Northwestern won the hoops title before going nearly 9 decades without getting back into the tourney. And freaking Cab Calloway had the most popular song in the U.S., and it sounded like this. It's like, what? I bump that every day when I work out. I feel like I'm watching a Little Rascals episode. Like, they're spanking Alfalfa. I mean, I could sit here all day long and rattle off bullet points from a year that none of us other than Rit were around for. But do I really need to? It's a story about a nearly 90-year-old man expecting a son this summer with a woman 46 years younger than him who has a stepdaughter 19 years older than her and 65 years older than the kid. I'm just sad that I missed the gender reveal party. Can you imagine this old dude packing his musket with either pink or blue gunpowder, making everybody wait 90 minutes while he set it up, and then firing off a cloud of dust into the air and having the recoil just put him flat on his back? Yeah, it's a boy. Bernie's down, everyone. Bernie's down. Help. Bernie's down. Somebody smash the life alert button around Bernie's neck.
I've fallen, and I can't get up.
89-year-old Burndog Ecclestone glossed the godfather of F1, and now he's about to become the actual father of a baby boy this summer. A baby boy whose father looks like a great-great-great-great-grandfather. My man, if you're still bumping uglies 9 decades in, man, do everybody a favor. Wrap it up next time. Because you know there's going to be a next time. My man, wrap it up next time. We are joined by Justin Simmons. Justin, how are you and your family doing right now with everything that's going on? Let me start right there, Justin. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing well. Thank you for having us. And I appreciate the, you know, the question kind of leading things off. We're family and I are doing, we're doing as best as we can, you know, just adjusting like everyone else probably is adjusting and kind of just taking it day by day and honestly finding ways to try and help the best we can while also, you know, making sure we execute social distancing. So it's been challenging. I know it's been challenging for a lot of people, but, you know, it's a unique position that we're all in. And I think, you know, the best way to get through it is just to be there for each other. So.
Justin Simmons, my guest. Justin, I think that kind of response will give the listeners an idea of who you are if they don't already know. In fact, you've been supporting Gen Youth's COVID-19 Emergency School Nutrition Fund, and that provides schools and grants or school grants for meal distribution and delivery. What made you want to get involved in the project and other work as it relates to food security specifically at this time?
Yeah, I think, you know, at least something that wasn't even brought to my attention was my wife actually brought it up to me was how schools were, you know, schools for a lot of these kids are how they get their meals, you know, at least breakfast and lunch. And so, you know, schools being canceled, there are a lot of kids that are now home and unfortunately don't have access to be able to get those meals, and they rely on school to provide them those meals. And so, stuff like Gen Youth, you know, we're also, you know, in and out of phone calls with the, you know, the Denver Public School Foundation stuff up there and, trying to just figure out like, hey, you know, what's the best way that we can offer our resources, you know, whether that's financial, you know, influential, just on our social media presence, like what's the best way that we can help, you know, these kids and these foundations to kind of, jumpstart or you know, get a good lead on these kids that aren't able to go to school to get their meals, because it's an unfortunate reality that we have, and it's unfortunate for those kids.
You know, good for you. I talked to Udonis Haslam of the Miami Heat earlier this week, and he said the very same thing about being in Miami. When he was growing up, one of the salvations or one of the saving graces was he could go to school and get the fish sticks. And when you're in the house, there's so many things that you don't have. You know, it's education first, but there's that structure of the school. And a lot of kids do depend on that for not only the structure, but the food. And you understand this too. Justin Simmons, my guest. From a football standpoint, a few weeks back, the Broncos announced they were using the franchise tag on you with the goal of signing you to a long-term contract. What was your reaction when you heard that bit of news?
Yeah, I think, you know, for me, it was, I think every free agent, right, at least when you're stepping into free agency, wants to go to a place where they're wanted and, you know, wants to go to a place where they know, you know, they're going to obviously contribute at a high level. And so for me, Denver being home the past 4 years and, you know, Elway coming out and saying like we're going to use franchise tag on him, you know, we want to work out a long-term deal, is one, it's refreshing for me because they know me the best out of any of the NFL teams, right? You know, I've been there for 4 years. They drafted me, you know, took a shot on me to start after my first year. And so they know me the best. And for them to, you know, kind of extend that they want to, you know, have me there and keep me there is really nice to hear. But, you know, it's like, as I've said, I know this is my first time being able to speak with you, but as I said throughout, you know, kind of throughout the season and obviously jumping into the off season of free agency, you know, at least the first bit of it, it has to work, you know, for both sides. And it just has to, unfortunately, it's the business side of things. It just has to work out on both sides.
I see you working. I get that response. Justin Simmons, my guest. You mentioned the draft. You told this really funny story that if we go back to the combine when you were coming out, the only interaction you had with the Broncos throughout the entire draft process was a scout coming up to you at the combine and saying, is this information correct? You said yes, and then he left, and that was it. So what was your reaction when they did select you?
Yeah, it was crazy. I honestly had no idea. I, you know, that story is literally like, I mean, that's it. Like, a guy came up to me. I can't even remember his name, but he came up to me, asked me if my information was correct during the combine, you know, craziness there, and you meet with all these different teams. I said, yes, sir, and he walked away. You know, months later, I get a call from Elway saying, welcome to Denver. It was just unreal because, you know, Denver had just came off a Super Bowl. Their defense was stacked. I mean, arguably one of the best defenses to play, and they were just stacked, especially at in the secondary. So I was like, no shot, Denver's looking for a safety. And I had minimal conversations with them, but lo and behold, you know, in the third round, I got that call from Elway, and it was just, Denver would have been on the bottom of my list of teams that I thought were interested. So
Justin Simmons joining us. It's such a great story because it's so unusual. But to your point, that secondary was loaded. I mean, you come in, it's a secondary that's got T.J. Ward, Darian Stewart, Aqib Talib, Chris Harris Jr., and more. What was it like as a young player to join that group?
Oh, man, it was so influential and inspiring. I think, you know, every young guy, especially, you know, coming into the league, like, all you're looking for is your opportunity to leave your mark and then never look back. And so, you know, for me, the thing I'm thinking about is, like, I'm ready to go to a team, I'm ready to contribute, and I'm ready to start, like, right out the bat. You know, I get drafted to Denver, and of course I know what their team is, regardless of if I was, you know, watching them throughout the season or not. Like, you know, all I had to do was watch one game, and that Super Bowl, man, you know, guys like Von Miller, Malik Jackson, DeMarcus Ware, they had Brandon Marshall and Danny Trevathan at linebacker. You know, they had Chris, Aqib, you know, TJ, Stu, Bradley Roby at nickel. I mean, like, they were just loaded all across the board on defense. And it was just crazy, you know, for me to be able to step into that role and kind of learn under those defensive minds and learn what made them great, you know, kind of, you almost can say kind of like redshirting my rookie season into the NFL, even though I did contribute a good bit. I think that really catapulted my career because I had the chance to learn from, you know, guys that were 7, 8, 9 years in and won a Super Bowl, had the experience, know the schemes. I think that really helped me a lot. It was really a blessing.
So, Justin, when you consider that, all these guys, I mean, some big-name guys, some Pro Bowlers, All-Pros, Super Bowl champs, Hall of Famers, and now, not that far into your career, you're the guy who's being looked at as the face of the secondary. You're the guy who's a leader on the team. Is it a challenge that feels like it's fun? And how do you go about approaching that? Because now you're one of those guys, and people are looking to you.
Yeah, no, I mean, I love it. I love the challenge. You know, I'm accepting it. I think we're doing such a great job. You know, I love the moves that have been made. You know, I think defensively we're setting ourselves up to kind of, you know, emulate what that Super Bowl 50 team had going. And those are great names and great players, like you said, All Pros, Pro Bowlers, Hall of Famers. And that's a lot to live up to, but I think that's the standard. You know, the Broncos country and everyone that follows Denver Broncos know that you know, you're playing them, you're playing a pretty good defense. And so that's the standard that you have to live up to. And, you know, there's no better challenge than to kind of live up to that from a secondary standpoint, especially with how today's pass game has been evolving consistently. And so I'm excited for it. You know, I think it'll be a great challenge, and I'm really looking forward to kind of seeing, you know, how the pieces fall into the puzzle. It'll be fun. I'm really looking forward to getting back to that standard.
Make no mistake, this defense is absolutely loaded. Justin Simmons joins us for a couple of more moments. Now, I did mention it in the intro. You have not missed a snap in the last 2 years. How much pride is there in that for you in knowing that your teammates can count on you literally, literally every single play?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think that's a crazy stat, first off. I think it's
I do, too.
I think it's an unbelievable testament to not only how I take care of my body, but for those around me that help me, you know, in order to do that. You know, the veterans on the team that I've played for a long time and, you know, still offer advice on how what they do and how year to year it kind of changes. And you got to be on top of the signs and all that stuff for your body. You know, I think our strength and conditioning staff, our training room, you know, all the resources available to me, you know, chiropractic massages, all those things that, you know, you kind of take advantage of and really stay on top of. I mean, it's just as important as watching film on your opponent. And so I think it's just a testament to all those different, you know, groups and resources that I have. And I like and honestly, like for me, it's not even the fact of keeping a streak going. But I think you alluded to it. I like the fact that my teammates know, like, hey, I can count on this guy to be there for me and to give his all, you know, every snap and to be out there for every snap. And, you know, for me, it's not necessarily the total amount of, you know, streaks that I've kept, but it's that fact that, like, hey, my teammates know, like, they can count on me to be there.
It's part of your relentless nature, and I want to just circle back to one thing before I let you go. You're also relentless when it comes to what you do off the field. As an example, Monday is supposed to be an off day, but you're generally doing community work on Mondays. I mean, you've set aside Monday to give back. You told The Athletic, quote, "For me, it's always been about something bigger than just I'm going to play this long, earn this much money, and focus on myself. Nothing wrong with people that do that, but I just feel like I didn't get here on my own. I don't want to keep it selfishly to myself." I think that's amazing. Where does the mindset come from, and then what's it mean to be able to give back the way you have?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the last part of that quote kind of sums it up for me. You know, I have no problem with the guys that, because it's tough, obviously, to get at this point. I mean, it's less than 1% of guys that make it into the NFL and have the opportunity to do what we do. And so, you know, your focus is focusing, you know, on your short career and getting what you can and then, you know, kind of focusing on stuff afterwards. Like, I get it. But while I have this platform, you know, temporarily, I didn't get here on my own. I had a lot of people help me along the way. I had a lot of people influence me. And so I want to make sure that I pay that forward, you know, 10 times, 20 times, 30 times fold, however much it can be. And while I have this platform, as temporary as it may be, I want to make sure that I'm kind of inspiring the next generation to do the same thing. Like, hey, here I am. I'm going to take the time out of my day, whether that's an off day, you know, whatever, and invest into our youth because they're worth it. Whether they have aspirations to play in the NFL or not, whatever career choice they have, you know, it's important for them to see someone that they may or may not look up to and to invest into them, shake their hands.
Joining us right now is a golf analyst. He is author of Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season. He is a friend of the program. He is Robert Lucetich. Robert, it's great to have you back. How are you?
Jim, always good to be back. And sorry for the surreal little delay we had earlier. I don't know what happened, but these are strange times that we are living in.
My friend, not a problem at all. These are very strange times that we are living in. I'm just glad that we could spend some time together. So I did a deep dive last hour, Robert, and the final chapter of your book, Unplayable, is titled The Reckoning, and it opens with Tiger Woods in Australia for the Australian Masters in November of 2009. Elin had stayed back in Orlando, but Tiger's mom was with him, and the routine was he'd have dinner with his mom, she'd go to her room, and then he'd hang out with Rachel Yucatel. For those who do not remember, who is Rachel Yucatel, and how would you describe her relationship with Tiger?
Well, Rachel Yucatel at that point in time was Tiger's girlfriend, one of, I should say. But she had a little bit, she was sort of, you know, more equal among the, sort of more important among the flock, because she had known him for a long time, and she had worked. People that don't know her, she actually became became somewhat well known the day after 9/11 because her fiance died in New York in the attacks, and she was on the front page of the New York Post, ironically. But Rachel was a sort of a social, fixer in a lot of ways, you could probably say. And she had put together parties and events and whatnot, had known Tiger for a long time. And I think my instinct tells me that she may have known where some of the skeletons were hanging in the closet.
Robert Lucetich is joining us. We can work our way back to that. But for context, how long had Tiger been carrying on Triss at that point? And what's your sense as to when that started?
Well, I mean, I think it had been going on for years, certainly well before his marriage. I think that, as one of his camp said to me one time, he didn't really look at it as anything but recreation, like going to the gym. And he kept that point of view. I think that if you go back, and one of the really formative moments in Tiger's life came when IMG and Nike, who were obviously both intimately connected with him, were looking around for what would be next after Michael Jordan. And Tiger Woods was very much a candidate, an obvious candidate. And so they thought maybe MJ could teach Tiger the ropes a little bit. And so they set up a meeting, and MJ said, wait for me after a game at the in Chicago. And Tiger waited, and MJ picked him up, and they spent the night at a riverboat casino. And I think Tiger started to learn that there's a lot of things you can do in this life, and with this level of fame and notoriety and wealth, and I think he went down that road. And I think we all know that his father was quite the ladies' man, or at least he liked the idea of being one. And so these influences, you know, they really came at an early age. We're talking right out, you know, essentially when he turned pro. So he was in his early 20s. And I think that the part of him that wanted to get married, the other part of him, which is the part that was indulged, wanted to continue having this life. And he really, in a lot of ways, he lived his life. He was incredible at compartmentalizing his life. And so this was just a compartment, and it had really nothing to do in his mind with his marriage, his children, and that part of his life.
We're talking to Robert Lucetich, journalist. He is the author of Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season. You know, I want to get to that point about him putting things in boxes or compartmentalizing, but you could tell it had been connected, Robert, with a couple of women in Vegas, Jennifer Lee Madden and Ashley Sampson. These two women went to the National Enquirer with info about you could tell and Woods. How much does this entire story have its roots in you could tell snubbing Sampson one night at a Japanese restaurant in Vegas?
Well, this is honestly, I'm sure you know, the whole world's been watching the Tiger King show, and you think, how weird is this? Well, let me tell you something. This Tiger King story is just as weird as anything you'll see from Joe Exotic. So,
well done.
Rachel Lucatel put together a let's call it a trip with some girls from Vegas to meet some guys from London who were wealthy guys. Two of the girls from Vegas didn't quite get what it was about. They just thought it would be, we'll go to Spain, we'll have this great life, and we'll have a lot of fun. And they didn't realize that there was a quid pro quo. They ended up going back to Vegas. She put him on a plane. The whole thing was a disaster. She gets back to Vegas and happens to see these two, and they're sort of mending fences at a Japanese restaurant in Vegas. And who else happens to be in that restaurant but Jeremy Piven? Which is quite appropriate, because this whole thing looks like it's a storyline from Entourage. And she sits with Jeremy Piven and essentially blows off the other two. And these two girls, very miffed, think to themselves, you know what? We're gonna call the National Enquirer, and we're gonna tell them all about Tiger and Rachel Lucatel. And the irony of the whole thing is that the National Enquirer, to my knowledge, paid them $25,000, which they shared. And I'd say the Tiger might have paid them just a little bit more to keep their mouths shut. And that, in fact, started the whole story, because after this, and you've got to remember that there was history between Tiger and the National Enquirer. Beforehand, a few years beforehand, they had what Tiger thought was photographs of him with another woman. But what Tiger didn't know and Tiger's camp didn't know was that the photographs were very grainy. They weren't very clear. So the Enquirer, being clever people that they are, cut a deal so Tiger would do a cover story for one of their other titles, Men's Fitness. And I remember at the time thinking, why is Tiger doing, he doesn't do anything for free, or certainly anything for, you know, without having a reason. And I thought, why would he do the cover of Men's Fitness? It just didn't make any sense. Well, that was the reason. The reason was that the Enquirer agreed to essentially hush up this evidence they had of an affair of another woman in return for this cover. So now fast forward, the Enquirer is now back at it, but this time they've got their teeth into a much better story, and they send one of their reporters down to Melbourne at the Crown Casino, which is quite opulent in Melbourne. Tiger was there to play the Australian Masters, and the reporter waited until he saw Uchitel, walked into the elevator, and waited for her to produce the key to the 35th floor, which there are only two penthouse suites on that floor, and he knew Tiger was in one of them, and as soon as she did, he confronted her, and of course she said that she didn't know what he was talking about, but by then it was too late, and they started putting together, you know, in fact, really, Rachel herself was responsible for putting together a sort of a crisis PR strategy. And one of the mistakes that they made was that Tiger told Elin, his then wife, that the Enquirer would be producing a story and it was just all nonsense and it was false. And if he'd have left it there, and this is one of the things about this story that it always blows my mind, is that all of these things had to happen, and they had to happen in a very particular order. So it was a perfect storm, but it was a perfect storm with the correct sequencing. If Tiger had just said, this is nonsense and, you know, just another BS story, I think Elin would have just believed that, because she already believed that the tabloids just made stories up. But instead, to sell it, he put her on the phone with Rachel Uchitel, who has a very raspy, sort of a husky, too many cigarettes late at night voice. And she spoke to her for 20 minutes, and Rachel said, this is just a couple of girls trying to get even with me, and they're being vindictive, and it's got nothing to do with Tiger. And of course, we fast forward a couple of days to Thanksgiving, and when Elin's wondering who Tiger would have called so late at night, and she dials that number, well, she recognized the voice.
Robert Lucetich is joining us, and that's exactly what happened. He went to play poker with some friends. He returns home. He calls her. The number is saved under a different name. Elin calls that and recognizes the voice. You know, Robert, there's always been that rumor that she hit Tiger with a golf club. What is your sense as to the likelihood of whether or not that's true? Where do you come out?
Oh, I think it probably was true. I mean, it was what I was told from a pretty good source is that she threw his phone at him. You got to remember, Tiger had taken Ambien, so he was very, very dazed and confused, half asleep, and they're having an argument. What I was told was that she threw his phone at him and that it hit him in the lip and chipped his tooth. And in the coming days after this, Tiger was not available for any police interviews. And the reason he wasn't, it was because that he had flown from the hospital in Orlando to Phoenix to see a plastic surgeon to get his tooth fixed and his lip fixed. And so again, it's one of these stories that just, it spiraled out of control. And one of the things that really strikes me is just how unprepared and how just completely inadequate his agent, Mark Steinberg, and the team around him were. They just couldn't deal with it. And Tiger, in the end, ends up essentially going into hiding, which was facilitated by his old friend Arnold Palmer. He was who gave him a place to stay and lay low, and he literally changed his phone number and just didn't pick up the phone. But as Hank Haney would tell me about a year or so later, you know, Tiger would read Radar Online, and not only read the stories, he'd read the comments, which is only going to make you insane, I think.
I, for the life of me, I can't even imagine why somebody in that position would do something like that. Robert Lucetich is joining us. His book is called Unplayable, an inside account of Tiger's most tumultuous season, and joining us to break this whole thing down. I, to your point, how you could read those articles, much less the comments, is unbelievable. But to your other point about his team and how badly they handled this, the lip impacted the way he spoke. So instead of getting in front of a camera, he was issuing statements on his website. How bad of a strategy was that at that time?
Well, I mean, it's you know, let's go back to Joe Exotic. I think you'd rather have him in charge. I mean, it was a nightmare. It was a free for all, and they never got ahead of the story. They never understood the way the media works. When you've got choppers overhead, you've got news helicopters overhead. There's no point hiding. You've got to come out. You've got to get in front of it. And it took them so long to understand that. And you've got to remember that they've always only dealt pretty much with the golf media. And the golf media was just far more, I would say, compliant, in a sense where, you know, you ask for an interview, they say no, and you say, okay. Well, that's not going to work with the National Enquirer. That's not going to work when you've got helicopters overhead and you've got a beast that needs feeding. And they just completely underestimated the impact of the story, the bigness of the story. I mean, it's Thanksgiving weekend. There's not a lot going on. This is the story. And they just thought, well, if we just issue some statements and we just don't say anything, it will go away. And honestly, I think if you're go to universities across America, maybe even the world now, under Crisis Management 101, how not to do it, Tiger Woods 2009.
So let me ask you this before you go. Like, if it broke a little bit differently, if one of the sources of the Enquirer story was not offended by Yucatel snubbing her, if Tiger's team could get to any of these people, including Jamie Grubbs, before she went to Us Weekly, or if they had paid off any of these people, is it possible this story never happens?
It's very possible. I really think that it is possible. I think that, let's think about, you know, how many times, you know, we know what we know because it ends up getting leaked, but how close are we to never knowing it? And this was definitely, I mean, we didn't know 2 years before when the Enquirer had him, they thought they had him red-handed, and nothing ever came out. So yeah, there's a lot of things if you know, he had a Beverly Hills lawyer who was essentially a Ray Donovan character with bags filled with money going to women, and Tiger would have to write down the names of all these women, and they'd try and find them, and they'd try and get their cell phones, their laptops, and give them money. I mean, it's just it's crazy.
Ray Donovan would have fixed that for sure. So finally, Tiger goes to rehab, and then in February he speaks to his family, friends, and business acquaintances at the PGA Tour headquarters. Leave us with this thought. As you think back on that speech, what do you remember most about it?
I mean, the desperation that he, to me, the desperation that he wanted this over with and done, and that I just... Part of me thinks that he did feel at the time that he felt, you know, some level of sorrow and contrition. But I think most of it, I think Tiger's a different guy now. I think Tiger's a more mature person. And I think in a lot of ways he's not as indulged as he was. But back then, it was still, to me, I was thinking to myself, you know, he's doing this because he wants it to go away. And I'm not sure how honest it really was. But again, I think that, you know, we all grow in different ways. His life is a life that none of us could know, because, you know, when you're told you're special and you're the next Gandhi and, you know, all of this stuff, it has an impact, and you don't think that the rules apply to you. And Tiger felt back then that he was bulletproof. And I think that, you know, we've seen a different Tiger now. And I think that DUI from a couple of years ago really was rock bottom. And that, I think that changed him more than anything. But you know, it certainly was, when you look back on it, just one of the more incredible stories. And certainly I was writing a book on Tiger at the time, and I had to write that last chapter as it was happening. And it was quite something.
Welcome to the jungle. What's going on? My name is Jim Rome. So how was that weekend? How you living? How was your life? Got a very nice radio experience for you once again. All right, so let me start here. Here's a storyteller that I did not see coming.
It's Carmelo Anthony.
Correct.
Melo had stories. Melo had stories for days.
Yeah! I look up. The current is taking me in the middle of the ocean.
We couldn't see you.
I know. Them little flippers wasn't working for me.
You know, I always say, we don't really know any of these guys. Like, how much more do you like Melo after hearing that story? You knew it was going to be good when Melo said the most disrespectful anybody can do is
touch your braids.
All right, low score on the hole from here for two. And given that you're fighting 40 yards, what kind of odds are you laying?
No odds.
Man, how painful was that? Could you even hear them talking above the mouth breathing? They can't do this. Seeing these two busted up and broken down dudes on a golf course running the weakest smack ever is not going to make anybody feel better.
As good as you're swinging?
It's intimidating, huh?
Javon Hargrave of the Eagles joining us.
Man, I got a Peloton bike. I just did the 60-minute ride today.
Right, they're tough, aren't they?
Yeah, they're tough.
How many calories do you burn during your ride?
700.
Burning.
See, Jim Rome, I told you about Stiddy. Who needs an old guy when you got a 23-year-old stud? This ain't my first rodeo, radio man.
Trash pickup was Friday, and there's a couple cans still out there on the street. Idiot.
Emailed. Will you please call my husband? He's sitting in his underwear, watching TV, and scratching his junk.
You touched my junk.
Find him and tell him yourself, Wendy.
Okay, did you want us to come over and shoot her? I met MC Hammer at the airport bar in San Jose, California. MC, why don't we just fire Nelson and make Weber the head coach?
I'm torn between asking you to call and then snatching your soul when you do call. Dave Roberts.
It's actually been good. I know you have a young college student, and I have one who now is doing online classes. I've got a sophomore daughter, and to kind of get us all back under the same roof has actually been a treat.
Check out our other website.
Are you going to tell me that guy? I can't believe that guy, that voice, isn't the guy who sings like this. First of all, it's like a ripoff, isn't it, of I Saw a Cat Mate.
We see cat,
shake it.
I don't harm tigers. I love tigers. I love white tigers. Do I own tigers personally in my house? No. People are going to make their own opinions.
You know how I
feel. Again, I was just a visitor. I met this guy. Not my friend. Don't know him. Never had any business dealings with him.
Michael Brockers is my guest. How are you?
Man, I'm doing great. Doing great. How are you doing with all this craziness?
Hanging in there. Trying to stay positive and upbeat.
Yo, Romeo. From reaching over tray and cell block D to my job cleaning trays at Mickey D's. You're welcome.
I'm the Twilight Zone marathoner, smack.
Again, Sean Payton is like the smartest guy ever. What? No play call for Ikes? How is there not an Ikes play call?
It's lit!
It's me! I'm old! Molly Seidel is my guest.
Crossing that line, it's just this enormous sense of, like, one, relief, because you don't have to run anymore. You finally get to rest. But also just like, wow, like, I can't believe that actually happened.
She kind of lit up, though.
Oh, how'd you do?
She lit up?
It's something us runners understand.
Stop trying to relate to an Olympic athlete's struggle at mile 20.
Son, your ego is writing checks your body can't cash.
Holy crap, Rick.
I don't know if they're going to rob me or what. Bang! I knock him out then. Bang! And I knock him out. And then a third guy comes walking into the bathroom. And he says, I don't know if he was with them or no, bang, and that knocks him out as well.
I mean, you can take a knee and try.
Jeff Pearlman joining us.
A lot of people I talk to think Brett Favre's final throw as a Viking was against the Saints. A lot of people don't even remember his last year when he started 13 games. He had 11 touchdowns, 19 interceptions. He was just done at that point.
Woo! Udonis Haslam. I wish I had more time. I want to ask you about D.C.
I could tell you a story about him.
Tell me.
Man. Damn, D.C., I say, that was kind of hard foul. Did you mean to hit me like that? Hey, let me tell you something, young fella. If I meant to hit you like that, you would know it.
He is Jamal Crawford.
When you truly love something, nobody has to tell you, hey, let's go do this. Or, you know, you find yourself doing it, and you always want to do it. You become obsessive about it. And when you're obsessive about it, you want to be the best you can be at it. And that's where the work ethic and the love and the passion comes from.
Four legendary voices that I associate with L.A.
Who are right about everything.
Chick Hearn, Vin Scully, Stu Nahan, and yourself.
Jim Rome.
What happened?
Elon never hit me that night.
Got away from my Buddhism.
Was it worth it?
Tiger Woods sucked.
You know, the whole world's been watching the Tiger King show. This Tiger King story is just as weird as anything you'll see.
Well done. Yeah, it's a boy.
Jim, get up.
Jim, thank you so much for keeping our national conversation going.
Barracuda.
Excuse me, my bad, Hammer. Your house.
You better have a take or you'll get run.
In his pants, he dropped a deuce.
Turtle Rock is a hotbed of professional athletes.
If I were going to, you know, if somebody wanted to kill you.
Tiger Shishimi.
All the best, Romy. Thanks for having me on.
Respect.
Good night now.
What's up, brah? What's up?
What's up, brah?
There you go.
Never has Turtle Rock gotten so much run ever, anywhere, at any time.
It's true.
I've been taking a victory lap all morning, bro. I put a hurting on the microwave in the kitchen, bro. The thing was so dirty, bro. It didn't stand a chance, man. I took that thing down. I'm maybe going to post a picture on Twitter about it later. I loved this week of content. It was awesome. Udonis Haslam was so thoughtful, bro. That came out of nowhere. I wasn't expecting that. I know I'm a little biased being a teacher, but his point, and you know, I know a lot of people are waking up to the fact that kids get sometimes breakfast and lunch at their schools, and we know that, but I thought Haslam made another great point in that there are a lot of kids who, for them, school is like a safe harbor and a place to get away from maybe a troubled home and things like that. And I know here in Orange County, one of the richest counties in the country, especially in the beach cities, we kind of lose sight of that. And I did my student teaching in Long Beach Unified, so I got a little bit of a different picture. But there's still some districts around here like that, and I know I'm a little biased, but a lot of these kids, you know what I mean? It's not just about seeing their friends and getting an education. It's about a respite from trouble and a place where they can maybe come into contact with some role models, be they teachers, coaches, guidance counselors, things like that. So I thought that was a great interview, bro. Also, my sister said something to me interesting yesterday. My mom convinced me to come over and fix the screen door because my dad's been putting it off. So, but they're retired, so that's what a son's for anyway. My sister is an RN at Long Beach Memorial. And they've got, like, I think 10 or so COVID cases, but she's in the rehab wing, so she deals with, like, stroke recovery and stuff. But the people who we've been lauding the most, the doctors and nurses, sometimes end up being the most isolated. And my sister mentioned something about, she was being, hyping it a little bit, a scarlet letter. She has friends who won't even, like, they're not coming within 10, 12 feet of her because she works at a hospital. So I just want to make the point that some of these people who are doing the hardest work are getting isolated the most, even more so than we are with our social distancing. Like they won't even want to take walks with them and stuff, even if they stay distant. So I'm not saying run up and hug a nurse or a doctor, but don't isolate them more so than you're isolating yourselves or which are just your regular friends. Cause that's going to definitely take a psychological toll on those frontline people. Anyway, brah, great show this week, brah. And I'll be listening since, as you know, school's canceled for the rest of the year, bruh. Later, bruh.
Good night now!